A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote in with a question about something I suspect every single person listening has felt but never quite named. You've had the day, short on sleep, buried in work, running on coffee and grim determination. And then somewhere in the late afternoon or early evening you hit it. Not exhaustion. You could still go meet a friend. Not sleepiness. You could stay up another full day if you had to. It's the war where your brain simply won't do any more hard thinking. Cat videos? Fine. A real conversation? Absolutely not. Daniel's asking what's actually happening in the brain at that moment. Is the feeling of a finite daily reserve of focus literally true? Why can caffeine keep you working longer but never push you through that wall? And what does it mean for knowledge workers whose entire livelihood is their ability to think on demand?
The short version is that the feeling is real, and we now have the neurochemistry to prove it. But before we get to glutamate and circuits and effort pricing, I want to be precise about what this thing is, because it's not one thing, and the distinctions matter. Cognitive fatigue, sometimes called time-on-task fatigue, isn't sleepiness. It isn't physical exhaustion. It isn't boredom, although boredom can accompany it. It's a task-specific depletion of your capacity for effortful cognition. And the key word there's effortful. The brain isn't a muscle, but it does burn fuel, and the systems that do the hard work of sustained attention and working memory have real metabolic limits.
So when Daniel says it feels like a reserve, like most days, he burns 60%, and these marathon days, he burns the whole allocation. He's not speaking metaphorically. There's a literal biochemical account.
That's what the last few years of work has shown. Neuroscience spent decades treating fatigue as a folk concept, something too vague to study. Then the tools caught up. Magnetic resonance spectroscopy, better animal models, finer fMRI analysis, and suddenly, the folk concept had a mechanism. Three mechanisms, actually, and they converge on the same region of the brain.
Walk me through it. What's the geography?
The lateral prefrontal cortex. It sits right behind your forehead, slightly to the sides. This is the seat of cognitive control, holding things in working memory, suppressing distractions, switching between tasks, making decisions that require overriding your immediate impulse. It's the part of your brain that does the thing you mean when you say you're concentrating, and it's metabolically greedy. It burns a disproportionate share of your brain's energy budget when it's active, which means it produces metabolic byproducts, and one of them is glutamate.
Glutamate, the excitatory neurotransmitter.
Right, but it's more than a neurotransmitter. It's also a metabolic intermediate. When neurons in the lateral prefrontal cortex fire hard for hours, glutamate accumulates in the extracellular space. Not because anything is broken, just because the clearance systems can't keep up with the production rate. And in 2022, a group led by Antonius Wheeler published a study in Current Biology that measured this directly. They had people do a full day of demanding cognitive work and then used magnetic resonance spectroscopy to measure glutamate levels in the lateral prefrontal cortex. The hard task group showed significantly elevated glutamate compared to the easy task group. And here's the kicker. The people with the highest glutamate accumulation were the ones whose performance dropped the most and who, in a follow-up economic game, showed the strongest preference for low-effort options.
So the brain, sitting in a soup of its own metabolic exhaust, starts making choices that reduce the amount of thinking it has to do.
That's exactly the read. And it's not a metaphor. Glutamate in the extracellular space changes the local physiology. It shifts the balance of excitation and inhibition. It makes the neurons in that region less efficient at sustaining the high-frequency firing that effortful cognition requires. So the wall Daniel's describing, the point where you can still be awake, still be conscious, still scroll a feed, but can't hold a complex thought, that's the lateral prefrontal cortex running in a degraded state.
One region, one molecule. You said three mechanisms.
The second one came out of a 2024 study in Cell Reports, Elgrawani and colleagues. They were working with sleep-deprived mice, and they found that a specific circuit within the lateral prefrontal cortex becomes functionally impaired under sleep deprivation. But the crucial finding was that this impairment could be dissociated from sleep pressure itself. In other words, the thing that makes you sleepy and the thing that makes you unable to sustain effortful cognition aren't the same system. They travel together a lot of the time because the same conditions produce both, but they're separable. You can be well rested and still hit the cognitive wall. You can be sleep deprived and, for a while, still think clearly.
That's the part that surprises people, I think. The assumption that the wall is just sleepiness, wearing a different hat.
And it's wrong. The 2024 mouse work shows the fatigue system is its own thing. It has its own circuitry, its own dynamics, its own time course. That's why Daniel can say accurately that the wall isn't a wall of fatigue in the sleepiness sense. He could stay up another 24 hours. The sleep system still has capacity. What's depleted is the cognitive control system.
And the third mechanism?
This one's about motivation, but not in the way people usually mean. In 2025, Vikram Chib and colleagues published an fMRI study in the Journal of Neuroscience looking at how the brain prices effort as fatigue builds. What they found was that the anterior cingulate cortex, a region that sits kind of wrapped around the front of the corpus callosum, increasingly encodes the cost of effort. As cognitive fatigue accumulates, the ACC's representation of how expensive a given mental action is goes up. So it's not just that you can't do the thing. It's that your brain is now quoting you a higher price for the thing, and your cost-benefit calculation is tilting toward disengagement.
So the wall is three things at once. A metabolic signal, glutamate, a circuit-level impairment, the lateral prefrontal cortex not firing the way it should, and a motivational recalibration, the ACC saying this is no longer worth what it costs.
And they're all converging on the same experience. The subjective feeling of a finite reserve is tracking something real. It's not a character flaw. It's not weak willpower. It's a biological signal with a physical substrate.
Which brings me to the thing I find strange about all of this. The brain has a system that tells you to stop thinking hard, and the signal it sends isn't pain, exactly. It's more like a price increase. The thought becomes too expensive to hold.
And that's adaptive in an evolutionary sense. The lateral prefrontal cortex is doing work that, in the ancestral environment, was probably reserved for genuine emergencies. Planning a hunt, tracking a predator, solving a novel problem. You don't want that system running at full tilt indefinitely. It's expensive. It produces metabolic waste. The brain solution is to make continued effort feel increasingly aversive, so you stop before you damage something.
Before you damage something. That's the part I keep turning over. The wall as protective mechanism.
Possibly. We don't have direct evidence of damage from overuse in humans. That's hard to study ethically. But the logic is sound. Glutamate at high concentrations is neurotoxic. The brain has good reasons to keep it from accumulating indefinitely. The fatigue signal may be the brain's way of saying, I need to clear this out before it becomes a problem.
So when Daniel says he can watch cat videos, but any intellectual conversation is off limits, that's the effort-cost calculus in action. Cat videos don't require sustained lateral prefrontal engagement. They're passive. The ACC isn't quoting a high price for passive consumption, but a real conversation. Tracking someone else's argument, holding their points in working memory, formulating a response. That's exactly the kind of thing the lateral prefrontal cortex does, and it's exactly the thing that's now priced too high.
And this is the part that feels so strange from the inside. You're not unconscious. You're not even particularly sleepy. You're just done. The machinery for effortful thought has been taken offline, or at least throttled way down, while the machinery for being awake and responsive is still running fine. That's the dissociation Elgrawani's mouse work pointed at.
Let's talk about caffeine, because Daniel's observation about it's sharp. Caffeine keeps you working longer, but it never pushes you through the wall. Why?
Because caffeine works on the wrong system. Caffeine is an adenosine receptor antagonist. Adenosine is the molecule that builds up in your brain the longer you're awake, and it's the primary driver of sleep pressure. Caffeine works by blocking the receptors adenosine would normally bind to, so the sleepiness signal gets muffled. You feel more awake. But the cognitive fatigue system, the glutamate accumulation, the lateral prefrontal circuit impairment, the ACC's effort pricing, that's not adenosine driven. Caffeine does nothing to clear glutamate. It does nothing to restore the lateral prefrontal circuit. It just makes you feel less sleepy while the cognitive control system continues to degrade.
So you can be wide awake and cognitively depleted at the same time.
And that's the coffee paradox Daniel's describing. The caffeine extends your wakefulness, so you can keep sitting at the desk. But it doesn't extend your capacity for effortful thought, because the thing that's limiting that capacity isn't the sleep system. It's the metabolic state of the lateral prefrontal cortex. You're awake, alert even, and still unable to do the hard thinking.
That's a nasty combination, actually. Awake enough to keep working, too depleted to do the work well.
And it explains a phenomenon I saw constantly when I was in clinical practice. People would come in exhausted, describe exactly this wall, and then say they'd been drinking more coffee to push through. But the coffee only made them more awake while their judgment was still degraded. They'd be jittery and depleted at the same time. The worst of both worlds.
You know what this reminds me of? Driving a car with a clogged fuel filter. You can press the accelerator harder, but the engine's not getting more fuel. The problem isn't the pedal.
That's a decent analogy. The caffeine is the pedal. The glutamate is the clog.
So, what's the actual fix, if caffeine isn't it?
Time. The glutamate has to be cleared, and that happens through a combination of rest and, paradoxically, sleep, but not in the way people assume. Sleep helps because it reduces the demand on the lateral prefrontal cortex, not because it directly scrubs the glutamate. The clearance systems work better when the region isn't actively firing. So a night's sleep does restore function, but it's not the sleep per se. It's the cessation of effort.
What about switching to a different kind of task? I've noticed, and I'm sure Daniel has too, that after hitting the wall with analytical work, I can sometimes still do something physical, or something creative that uses a different part of the brain.
That's consistent with the regional specificity of the effect. The glutamate accumulation is in the lateral prefrontal cortex. If you switch to a task that doesn't heavily recruit that region, something physical, something automatic, something that relies on well-practiced routines, you're not asking the depleted system to keep working. You're giving it a break while other systems take over. It won't fully restore the lateral prefrontal cortex, but it stops the further accumulation.
So the wall isn't global, it's local.
Mostly local. There's probably some global component, general metabolic state, inflammation, that kind of thing, but the core of the effect is regional. The lateral prefrontal cortex is the bottleneck.
Let's get to the knowledge worker question, because that's where Daniel lands, and it's the part with real stakes. If your main asset is sustained cognitive output, and the ceiling is biochemical, then the standard 8-hour knowledge workday is built on a false assumption.
The assumption being that cognitive capacity is roughly constant across the day, like a machine that runs at the same speed until you turn it off. But the evidence says it's more like a battery that drains with use and recharges with rest. And the recharge isn't linear. The first few hours of hard focus are cheap. The last few are ruinously expensive in terms of the metabolic cost and the degradation in output quality.
How many hours of genuine hard focus do you actually get?
The honest answer is we don't have a precise number, and it varies by person and by task. But the research suggests the wall tends to arrive after 4 to 6 hours of demanding cognitive work, not 4 to 6 hours of being at your desk. 4 to 6 hours of the hard stuff, the deep work, the difficult analysis, the novel problem solving. After that, you're running on degraded machinery.
Which means most knowledge workers are spending their afternoons doing low-quality work and calling it productivity.
Or doing the easy stuff. Email, meetings, administrative tasks, and mistaking that for the same kind of output. The brain is smart about this. When the lateral prefrontal cortex is depleted, you naturally gravitate toward tasks that don't require it. The danger is when you don't notice the shift and keep trying to do hard work with a depleted system. You produce worse work, you make more errors, and you reinforce the cycle.
There's a knock-on effect here I want to pull out. If the wall is real and hits after 4 to 6 hours of hard focus, then the modern knowledge workday is structurally misaligned with the brain's actual capacity. And this isn't about hustle culture or laziness. It's about the mismatch between economic assumptions and biological limits.
The economic assumption being that a knowledge worker's output scales with hours worked. But if the marginal output of the 5th and 6th hours is dramatically lower than the 1st and 2nd, then the 8-hour day is partly theater. You're paying for presence, not for cognition.
And the worker themselves might not even notice, because the decline is gradual, and the brain is good at rationalizing. You think you're still working at full capacity, but the ACC has already quietly shifted your effort pricing, and you're now doing the easy version of the task without realizing the hard version is no longer available.
That's the insidious part. The fatigue doesn't announce itself. It just makes the hard thing feel less worth doing. And you find yourself doing the easy thing instead, and you tell yourself you're still being productive.
Daniel mentioned he's short on sleep on these marathon days. How does that interact with the fatigue system?
This is where the El-Ghrawani finding gets really relevant. Sleep deprivation doesn't just add sleep pressure. It also impairs the lateral prefrontal circuit's ability to sustain effort in the first place. So on a short night, you start the day with a degraded system. The wall hits earlier and harder. You're not just tired, you're cognitively compromised from the first hour, and the reserve you're drawing on is smaller to begin with.
So the sleep-deprived marathon day is a double hit. Less capacity, and the capacity you have drains faster.
And the caffeine makes it worse in a subtle way. By masking the sleepiness, it lets you keep working past the point where the fatigue signal would normally have told you to stop. You're overriding one protective system while another one is degrading underneath you. The result is that you can push yourself into a state of profound cognitive depletion without the subjective sleepiness that would normally accompany it.
That's a recipe for bad decisions.
It's a recipe for exactly the kind of errors that show up in accident reports. People who are awake, alert, and functionally impaired.
Let me ask you something. When you were practicing medicine, did you see this in yourself? The wall?
Constantly. Long shifts, complex cases, the need to hold multiple patients' histories in working memory while making decisions under time pressure. And the wall would hit at a certain point, and I'd know I was past it because I'd start doing things I never did when I was sharp. Rereading the same chart, double-checking things I'd already confirmed, avoiding the hard diagnostic reasoning, and defaulting to the obvious answer. The scary part was that I didn't always notice it happening. It took a colleague pointing it out sometimes.
That's the thing about the wall. It's not just that you can't think. It's that you lose the ability to accurately assess whether you're thinking well.
Metacognition goes too. The system that monitors your own cognitive performance is itself a cognitive system, and it's running on the same depleted machinery, so you can be past the wall and believe you're still sharp. That's the most dangerous state.
Which brings us to the practical question. If the wall is real and biochemical, what do you actually do about it? Not productivity hacks. What does the neuroscience suggest?
The first thing is to stop treating the wall as a failure of willpower and start treating it as information. The feeling of being done is your brain accurately reporting its own metabolic state. The right response to that signal isn't to override it with caffeine and keep going. It's to stop asking the depleted system to work.
Rest, in other words?
Real rest. Not scrolling on your phone, that's still light cognitive load, and depending on what you're scrolling, it might be recruiting the lateral prefrontal cortex more than you think. Real rest is a walk, a nap, a physical task, a conversation about nothing in particular. Something that lets the lateral prefrontal cortex go offline.
And how long does recovery take?
That's the part we don't have a precise answer for. The glutamate clearance happens over hours, not minutes. A short break will buy you a little more capacity, but it won't reset the system. The full reset requires the kind of prolonged disengagement that sleep provides. Not because sleep is magic, but because it's the longest period of the day when the lateral prefrontal cortex isn't being asked to do anything hard.
So the 4-day workweek people might have a point. Not for lifestyle reasons. For metabolic ones.
There's a real argument that the 5-day, 8-hour cognitive workweek is asking more than the brain can sustainably deliver. Not every day is a marathon day, of course. Most days you're not running at full capacity. But the system has limits, and the current structure assumes those limits don't exist.
I want to push on one thing. You said the fatigue signal is protective. The brain telling you to stop before you damage something. But we also had this cultural story that pushing through fatigue is how you build capacity. That the marathon runners of cognition, the people who work 18-hour days for years, they're the ones who achieve great things. Is there any truth to the idea that you can train your way past the wall?
I don't think the evidence supports that. The wall isn't a muscle that gets stronger with use. It's a metabolic constraint. You can improve your efficiency, get more done per unit of cognitive effort, through skill and practice. That's real. An expert can do in 2 hours what a novice takes 8 hours to do, not because the expert has a bigger reserve, but because the expert's brain is doing the task more efficiently, recruiting fewer resources for the same output. So in that sense, training helps. But the underlying metabolic limit doesn't move much. Even experts hit the wall.
So the people who seem to work 18-hour days without hitting the wall, what are they actually doing?
A few possibilities. They might be doing work that's not actually that cognitively demanding. Work that's become so automatic it doesn't heavily recruit the lateral prefrontal cortex. They might be taking lots of small breaks that let the system partially recover. They might be interspersing hard work with easy work in a way that keeps the average load below the threshold. Or they might be lying about how much hard work they're actually doing.
That last one.
I'm not saying it's common, but the self-report of work hours is notoriously unreliable, and the self-report of focused hours is even worse. People remember being at the desk, not being in deep focus.
What about the people who do seem to have more cognitive endurance than others? Is there individual variation?
Some of it's probably genetic. Differences in glutamate clearance rates, differences in metabolic efficiency, differences in how the ACC prices effort. Some of it's training. Experts in a domain use less cognitive effort per unit of output. Some of it's lifestyle. Sleep quality, nutrition, exercise, all of which affect the metabolic substrate. But the variation is in where the wall sits, not whether it exists. Everyone has a wall.
Let me ask you about the future, because this is the part where it gets interesting. If the wall is real and we now understand the mechanism, could we intervene? Could we clear glutamate faster, or restore the lateral prefrontal circuit, or recalibrate the ACC's effort pricing?
In principle, yes. The mechanisms are physical, and physical mechanisms can be manipulated. In practice, we're a long way from a pill that restores cognitive capacity without side effects. The glutamate system is so fundamental to brain function that messing with it globally would have consequences everywhere. You'd need something that targets the lateral prefrontal cortex specifically, and we don't have that kind of precision yet.
And even if we did, would we want to? You said the wall is protective. If you override it, do you risk the kind of damage the wall exists to prevent?
That's the open question. The wall might be like pain, unpleasant but necessary. You can override pain with drugs, but then you injure yourself because you've lost the signal that tells you to stop. The same logic might apply to cognitive fatigue. The wall is the signal. Override it at your peril.
So, the wall is information. That's the reframe.
That's the reframe. The feeling of being done isn't weakness. It's your brain telling you something true about its own state. The question is whether you're listening.
I keep coming back to Daniel's framing. That this matters for anyone who uses their brain as their main asset. And the implication is uncomfortable. If the reserve is real and finite, then the person who structures their day around 4 hours of hard work and protects those hours and stops when the wall hits, that person might produce better work than the person who grinds for 12 hours.
Not might, probably does. The research on this is pretty consistent. Output quality degrades sharply past the point of cognitive fatigue. The person who stops at the wall and comes back tomorrow produces better work per hour than the person who pushes through. And the person who pushes through is also more likely to make the kind of error that costs days to fix.
So the productivity advice that says work less to achieve more, it's not just a lifestyle preference, it's a description of how the brain actually works.
With a caveat that the less has to be real. You can't just sit at your desk for 4 hours and call it done. The 4 hours have to be hard, the kind of work that recruits the lateral prefrontal cortex at full capacity. That's what depletes the reserve. If you're doing easy work, you're not drawing on the reserve, and you're not producing the kind of output that matters.
And the easy work, the email, the meetings, the administrative stuff, that's still work, still necessary, but it's not the thing that creates the value. The value comes from the hard hours, and the hard hours are limited.
Which is an uncomfortable thing to say out loud in a culture that treats hours worked as a proxy for contribution. But the neuroscience is what it is. The brain is a metabolic organ with limits. The limits are real. And the feeling of hitting them is the brain's way of telling you to stop.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the ACC and effort pricing. The idea that fatigue isn't just can't, it's won't, because the brain is now pricing effort differently. That's a strange thing to sit with. It means the wall isn't a failure of ability. It's a change in what the brain is willing to pay.
And that's why it feels so much like a choice, even though it isn't. You're not choosing to stop. The choice architecture has changed underneath you. The thing that was worth doing an hour ago is no longer worth doing, because the cost has gone up and the expected benefit hasn't. Your brain has repriced the action, and you're just along for the ride.
That explains the guilt, actually. The feeling that you should be able to push through, that you're just being lazy, because it feels like a decision. But the decision was made for you, at the level of the ACC, and your conscious experience is just the aftermath.
The guilt is real, and it's misplaced. You're not lazy, you're metabolically depleted. The distinction matters because the response is different. If you're lazy, the fix is discipline. If you're depleted, the fix is rest. And the person who tries to fix depletion with discipline just ends up more depleted.
There's a version of this conversation that turns into a productivity sermon. Here's how to structure your day. Here's how to protect your focus. Here's how to be a better knowledge worker. I don't want to do that. But I do think there's something worth saying about what this means, but how we think about work.
Say it.
The wall isn't an obstacle to work. It's a feature of the system. It's the brain's way of telling you that hard thinking is done for the day, and the right response isn't to fight it, but to accept it and plan around it. The people who do their best work understand this intuitively. They protect the hard hours. They don't waste them on email. They stop when the wall hits, not because they're weak, but because they know the wall is telling them something true.
And the people who don't understand it, the ones who grind through the wall with caffeine and willpower, they produce worse work and feel worse about themselves. The tragedy is that they think the problem is their discipline, when the problem is that they're asking a depleted system to keep running.
The practical takeaway, if there's one, is something like, find your wall, respect your wall, structure your day around the hours before it, and stop pretending the hours after it are worth much.
That's about as close to a productivity takeaway as I'm comfortable giving. The neuroscience supports it. The wall is real, it's measurable, and it's not going anywhere.
I wonder if Daniel's experience, the marathon days, the coffee, the desperation, is actually the worst way to use the reserve. You're starting depleted from the short sleep. You're drawing on the reserve from the first hour, and you're masking the fatigue signals with caffeine so you can't tell when you've hit the wall. It's the perfect setup for spending the afternoon doing low-quality work and thinking it's fine.
It's the perfect setup for exactly the scenario he described. The wall hits, and he can't do the intellectual conversation, but he's still awake, still at the desk, still technically working. The caffeine has kept the sleep system at bay while the cognitive system collapsed underneath it.
The next day, presumably, the reserve is smaller. Because the glutamate hasn't fully cleared. Because the sleep was short. Because the system never got the restoration it needed.
That's the cycle. Each marathon day makes the next one harder. The wall arrives earlier and hits harder. And the person in the cycle thinks they're just not disciplined enough when what they're actually doing is running a metabolic deficit.
The fix, to the extent there's one, isn't more caffeine. It's better sleep, protected hard hours, and the willingness to stop when the brain says stop.
Which is a hard sell in a world that rewards visible effort. But the visible effort is the problem. The person who's still at their desk at 9 p.m. looks like they're working harder than the person who stopped at 3. But the person who stopped at 3 might have done more actual thinking.
I want to hear from Hilbert on this, because I know he's had jobs where staying sharp wasn't optional.
It was the flight strips that got me. I worked 2 years as a night shift assistant at a regional airport in the late 90s. Not a controller. I ran the strips, coordinated with the adjacent sectors. And the wall had a texture. You'd be fine, and then suddenly you couldn't hold two strips in your head at once. You'd look down at the board and the information was there, but it wouldn't stay. The old-timers called it going strip blind.
Strip blind. That's a good name for it.
It wasn't sleepiness. We had coffee, we had the lights, we had the routine. You'd be wide awake. But the strips stopped meaning anything. You'd read the altitude and the heading and the call sign, and by the time you looked up, it was gone. That's when you knew you were dangerous.
What did you do when it hit?
The only thing that worked was getting up and walking. 10 minutes, maybe. Walk the length of the control room, stretch, get a glass of water. It didn't fix it, but it bought you another hour. The caffeine didn't do that. The caffeine just made you more awake while you were strip blind.
That's consistent with what we know. The walking is a modality switch. It takes the load off the lateral prefrontal cortex and lets the clearance systems work for a few minutes. It's not a reset, but it's a partial recovery.
I used to think it was just the blood moving, but you're saying it's the brain getting a break from the strips.
That's exactly what I'm saying. The strips, holding multiple pieces of information in working memory and updating them continuously, that's the hardest thing the lateral prefrontal cortex does. Walking doesn't require it. So the walk is a rest, even though you're still awake.
The alternative, staying at the board, drinking more coffee, trying to push through, that's how you miss a handoff.
That's how you miss a handoff. And in that room, a missed handoff isn't a bad day. It's a midair.
The stakes make the wall impossible to ignore. In an office job, you can hit the wall and just do bad word for a few hours. Nobody dies. But in a control room, the wall is a safety issue, and the culture has to account for it.
The culture did account for it, in its own way. The old-timers knew about strip blind. They'd watch for it in the new guys. If someone started staring at the board too long or rereading the same strip twice, that was the sign. They'd send you to walk it off, not because they were kind, because they didn't want to die.
That's the thing about the wall. In most workplaces, it's invisible. In a control room, it's a known failure mode with a name.
Strip blind. I still remember the feeling. The information is there, but it won't stay. It's like trying to hold water in your hands.
The walking. You said it bought you another hour. What happened after the hour?
Then you were strip blind again, and this time the walk didn't help as much. The second hour was always worse than the first. By the end of a bad shift, you were just trying not to make the obvious mistake. The hard thinking was gone.
That's the reserve depleting in real time. The walk gives you a partial recovery, but the underlying metabolic state is still degraded. Each cycle of work and rest gets you less.
Did the job change how you think about focus?
It taught me that focus isn't a mood. It's a resource. You spend it, and it's gone, and no amount of wanting it back makes it come back. The only thing that brings it back is time.
That's as clean a summary of the neuroscience as anything we've said today.
The coffee. You said it made things worse in a way.
It made you feel like you were fine when you weren't. That's worse than feeling tired. At least when you feel tired, you know to be careful. The coffee took that away.
The masking effect. You lose the signal that tells you you're depleted, so you keep working past the point where you should have stopped.
There's something darkly funny about the fact that the thing people use to push through the wall is the thing that makes the wall invisible.
I don't know about funny, but it's true.
Where does this leave Daniel's question? He asked what happens in the brain at the wall, whether the reserve is real, why caffeine can't push through it, and what it means for knowledge workers. I think we've answered all four.
The wall is glutamate accumulation in the lateral prefrontal cortex, circuit-level impairment in the same region, and a motivational recalibration in the anterior cingulate cortex. The reserve is real. It's a metabolic limit, not a metaphor. Caffeine can't push through it because caffeine works on the adenosine system, which is the sleep system, not the fatigue system. And for knowledge workers, the implication is that the standard 8-hour cognitive workday is asking more than the brain can sustainably deliver.
The question I'm left with is whether we're going to take the science seriously. The wall is information. It's the brain reporting its own metabolic state. And we live in a culture that treats that information as a problem to be overcome rather than a signal to be respected.
That's the open question. We now know what the wall is. The question is what we do with the knowledge. Do we restructure work around the brain's actual capacity? Or do we keep grinding through the wall and pretending it's not there?
The deeper question, if we do develop interventions that can clear glutamate or restore the lateral prefrontal circuit, do we want them? Or is the wall a protective signal we should be careful about overriding?
I don't have an answer to that. I think it's the kind of question we'll be wrestling with for a while. The wall might be like pain, unpleasant, but necessary. The trick is learning to tell the difference between the signal and the suffering.
That's a good place to land. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. If you want to send us a prompt, maybe about the neuroscience of something else you felt but never named, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us. show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.